You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. On this Wednesday, October 15th, we have a special guest with us in the studio. That's Todd Zwillick from the Capital News Connection in Washington. So welcome to our studios in New York.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we are going to go to Washington now on an important story. One of the latest estimates of the financial bailout plan puts the number at $2.25 trillion. That's triple the size of the $700 billion plan Congress passed a couple of weeks ago. At the heart is the nation's nine largest banks. Yesterday, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson called each of the bank's chief executives into a meeting and essentially demanded they sign on at the dotted line. But it wasn't so easy. Eric Dash, who's covering the story for the New York Times, joins us now from Washington. Welcome back, Eric.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So it almost sounded like high noon at the OK Corral, sign or else.
Well, look, I think that the Treasury Secretary obviously thinks this is a very important program, that the banks do need the money, and he wanted to also avoid stigmatizing any one bank for accepting the money. So if everyone was in this together, then they could sort of get all the banks to accept the money without criticizing or shedding some harsh light on one or two of the institutions that really need it.
Tell us about the meeting yesterday. The nine chiefs are called in. Were they expecting this meeting? And then what took place? There was a bit of tension in the room, as you reported.
Right. On Sunday afternoon, Hank Paulson called personally all the chief executives and said, come in. We're going to have this meeting. And, you know, but he wouldn't tell them the details of what they were going to expect. So I think many of them probably expected that these would be like previous sessions at the Treasury where they'd solicit ideas, give feedback. I think that they were in for a surprise when they heard that they were actually going to implement the program, and then they saw the size of the government investments.
So they were surprised that it was that specific, that Paulson was outlining a specific amount of money. What were some of the immediate concerns?
Oh, I think some of the concerns were some of the banks. Some of the banks said, "Look, you know, we don't need the money. We don't want the government playing a role in our institutions. These are men that are not used to being told what to do." At the same time, I think that there was also a lot of posturing and puffing going on because nobody wanted to show their hand and tell their peers that their institution was weak.
But is any of this made easier on Hank Paulson because he's one of their own? Or was it more of a shock, do you think, to the banking CEOs because he is one of their own and he was asking for something that's, in a way, anathema to their whole industry?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think that, you know, because he is one of the banking industry, he understands the problem, and he also understood that this would be difficult for these guys to swallow. So he tried to appeal in the best way that he could, appealing to the institution's interest, to their individual interest, and also putting in couching the this investment program in the national interest, invoking patriotism as he made this appeal.
And it seems like a different Hank Paulson than a couple of weeks ago we read got on bended knee in front of Speaker Nancy Pelosi and begged her not to scuttle the bailout package in Congress. It seems like he's kind of playing both sides of the character.
That's certainly one way to look at it.
Eric, let me ask you this. You really describe a scene where you have these very powerful men in the banking industry sipping Coke and drinking coffee and not quite sure whether this deal is good for their individual banks. Can you describe, you said that Wells Fargo is one of the banks that felt they didn't want to join the bailout program because they're in fine shape. How did the discussion go from there?
Well, I think, look, all of these bank executives sort of understand the severity of this crisis. It's unlike any of them have seen in their careers. I think, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of levity in the room, and I think that, you know, they understood sort of what the stakes were and what the government was going to do.
So what did they get?
So they got basically a a preferred investment that reflected about 3% of their balance sheet, and the government also got an opportunity to invest alongside. So it's a preferred stock investment that carries a 5% dividend paying coupon. That coupon then in 5 years, if it's not paid back, will rise to 9%.
You note in your article that some of the bankers realized that this was certainly a better deal than they would have gotten, say, from Warren Buffett, who would have extracted a greater return for the money he's lending.
Right. I think that's the other point, is that these guys, as soon as they saw the terms of this agreement, realized that this was a lot of money and that also the money was relatively cheap. It's at cheaper than market rates right now. So it's really designed in a way that is encouraging these guys to lend. Whether they do or not is a different story, but I think the fact that they have additional capital will free them up to make new loans, and that's what Treasury is hoping.
One of the major concerns has been about compensation, whether if the government is going to lend this money to investment firms or to banks, what are they extracting in return? In this deal, are there any limits on compensation?
There are, but it's very unclear about how practically enforceable they'll be. So I think that that's a lot of political posturing, and we'll have to see sort of where the beef is on these executive pay guidelines and requirements for accepting these investment stakes.
So last question for you, Eric. Has all the banks, have they signed on?
Well, all nine banks, or eight banks, plus Merrill Lynch, which is merging with Bank of America, have agreed to accept this investment. I think, and that's about $125 billion worth of government funds divided among those institutions. But sort of the next question is, well, what happens to the small and mid-sized banks? There's now about $125 billion allocated for the hundreds, if not thousands, of those institutions, and the government's certainly going to encourage them to take it. Whether they do or not is an open question.
Eric Dash, thank you always for your updates.
Sure.
Eric Dash is a reporter for the New York Times, coming to us from Washington, D.C. So now we're just adding another layer for politicians, Republicans or Democrats, to have to explain to, you know, the folks in their home districts of exactly what the government is doing. I mean, this is an enormous government intervention. I think potentially the largest ever.
Enormous, and more to come, because after these banks are done getting around Henry Paulson, they'll get to deal with Congress next year, which is promising to regulate their industry so that something like this doesn't happen again. So the fund's not over for us, or certainly for these nine banks, that's for sure.
And that's Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection, who's going to hang out with us this hour at The Takeaway. And Todd, you have been in the middle of all of these discussions about regulation, about deregulating, about anti-regulation. People forget there actually are laws on the books. The question is whether or not any of the enforcement agencies have been enforcing those rules, right?
That's been part of the question, whether or not enforcement of existing law has been adequate. I think there's a great case to be made that it hasn't been, or else we might not be where we are now. But also whether or not it's about loopholes. There's money to be made by finding the loopholes in the law and then structuring your business around them. For instance, credit default swaps, complicated derivatives. We hear about all these things. You say, well, why do they do such complex mathematical things to make money? It's because they get right through the loopholes that are in the law. And there were ways to make money by doing it.
And so this is something that no doubt when Congress comes back, they will be taking a very hard look. But right now, most politicians are at home campaigning, right?
That's correct. Almost all of them.
So is there anything happening on Capitol Hill except for what's happening at the Treasury Department?
Well, what's happening on Capitol Hill basically is the Treasury Department. There are hearings ongoing, but all of the hearings are about the financial bailout and about the economy. Don't forget, there is a true problem to talk about, but also the Democratic majority wants to keep talking about the economy. They want to keep talking about that. It's good for them.
So what's coming up in terms of those hearings?
Well, we've got a whole series of hearings that have been ongoing in the Financial Services Committee in the House. There have been a few. There will be
Henry Waxman.
Financial Services, Barney Frank of Massachusetts.
Okay.
There will be more hearings next week now on a potential stimulus package in the lame duck. They're talking about spending billions more to provide jobs, infrastructure programs, maybe rebate checks. That stuff is coming up. They're not going to let the economy issue go. And even some of the lesser committees are getting in on it. The Agriculture Committee has been holding hearings on credit default swaps and derivatives. They have jurisdiction over that somehow.
Interesting. Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection is going to be with us, just hanging out for the next hour.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.